Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode for today's conference. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, at which point, if you would like to ask a question, please dial star and then one to queue up. This call is being recorded. If you do have any objections, you may disconnect at this point. Now, I will turn the meeting over to your host, John Bateman. You may now begin the conference, John.
Good morning, and thank you for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have any additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email, and I will spell it. It is NESDIS.PA@NOAA.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the presentation our speakers will follow can be downloaded from the link in the media advisory. If you don't have that link, I will spell it for you so you can download the presentation. It is https://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/BRIEFINGS. With that, I will introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Karen Gleason, a climatologist with NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the July 2021 U.S. and global climate analysis, as well as the latest drought monitor update. Our second presenter is Dan McAvoy, a regional climatologist from the Western Regional Climate Center, who will provide information about the ongoing drought across the West and Northern Plains, as well as the associated wildfire activity. And our third presenter is Matt Rosenkranz, a meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña update, as well as the U.S. temperature, precipitation, and drought outlook for the months of September, October, and November. Our first speaker will be Karen from NOAA. Karen?
Thank you, John, and thanks to everyone for joining our call today. Let's start by looking at global temperatures for July on slide number two. As you can see from the temperature departure map on the left-hand side of the slide, warmer than average temperatures are denoted by shades of red, and cooler than average temperatures are denoted by shades of blue. The month of July was characterized by warmer than average temperatures across much of the globe. Much warmer than average temperatures were observed across parts of North America, the Northern and Eastern Europe, Northern Africa, the Middle East, Southern Asia, Northern and Southern parts of Argentina, as well as the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Oceans. Looking at the temperature percentiles map on the right-hand side of the slide, we see that record warm July temperatures were observed across parts of Western North America, the Atlantic Ocean, Europe, Northern Africa, Southern Asia, and small areas across the Southern Pacific and Indian Oceans. The record warm July temperatures encompass just more than 5% of the world's surface, which is the seventh highest July percentage for record warm July temperatures since records began in 1951. Meanwhile, cooler than average conditions were observed across parts of the South Central and Southeastern contiguous U.S., Northeastern Canada, Southern Africa, Northern Russia, and the Southeastern Pacific Ocean. However, no land or ocean areas had a record cold July temperature. As a whole for July 2021, the global land and ocean temperature was the highest value for July since global records began in 1880, with an anomaly of a positive 0.93 degrees Celsius or 1.67 degrees Fahrenheit above the the 20th century average. This value surpassed the previous record set in 2016 and also subsequently matched in 2019 and 2020 by 1/100 of a degree Celsius or 2/100 of a degree Fahrenheit. 9 of the 10 warmest Julys have occurred since 2010, with the last 7 Julys being the 7 warmest Julys on record. Regionally speaking, Asia had its warmest July on record, Europe's second warmest, and Australia fourth warmest. So turning our attention now to slide number 3 and looking at the temperature percentiles map on the left, we're looking at the January to July or year-to-date period. We see that warmer than average conditions were observed across much of the globe, with record warm year-to-date temperatures seen across parts of the Pacific Ocean, Africa, and Southern Asia. Near and to cooler than average temperatures were also present across parts of the Eastern Pacific Ocean, the South Central and Southeastern contiguous U.S., the North Atlantic Ocean, Central Russia, and the Southern Oceans. However, no land or ocean areas had a record cold January to July temperature. So for this year-to-date period, we see that the global land and ocean temperature was 0.81 degrees Celsius or 1.46 degrees Fahrenheit above average, which ties with 2018 for the 6th warmest such year-to-date period on record. Looking at the year-to-date global temperatures plot on the right-hand side of the slide, we see that what were ultimately the 10 warmest years on record for the globe and a comparison to the year-to-date temperature anomalies for 2021, which are denoted by the black line with dots. Each month along the trace represents the year-to-date average temperature anomaly. In other words, the January values, the January average temperature anomaly, and the February value is the average anomaly of both January and February combined, and so on. The average global land and ocean surface temperature through July 2021 tied with 2018, as I said previously, as the 6th warmest such period on record. And looking at the temperature raking outlook for 2021 and based on our current observed anomalies during the first 7 months of 2021, as well as the historical global annual temperature readings, it appears that it's virtually certain that 2021 will rank among the warmest 10 years on record. And in addition, there is less than a 4% chance that 2021 will end among the warmest 5 years on record, with our greatest confidence of the year ending between 5th and 7th warmest year on record. All right, turning our attention now to slide number 4 and zooming in a little closer to home, we see that the temperature average during July for the contiguous U.S. was 75.5 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit above average. This tied with 1954 and 2003 for the 13th warmest July on record. Looking at the temperature percentiles map on the left, we also see superimposed the rankings of those temperature percentiles, and you see above average temperatures and record temperatures across Western Plains and portions of the Mid-Atlantic and the Southeast. We also see below average temperatures observed across the Central Plains, the Southern Plains, Midwest, Southeast, and the Northeast. California, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington each had their warmest July on record. Now, for precipitation as a whole for the contiguous U.S., we averaged 3.36 inches during July, which was 0.58 inches above average, which equates to our 6th wettest July on the historical record. Looking at the precipitation percentiles map on the right, we see above average precipitation across the Northeast, the Southeast, the Great Lakes, portions of the Midwest, the South, and also parts of the Southwest. Drier than average conditions we saw across the Northwest and the Northern Tier states, as well as portions of the Central Plains, the Midwest, as well as the Appalachians. New York and Massachusetts both ranked wettest for July, and Minnesota ranked 2nd driest. Looking now at slide number 5 and the contiguous U.S. temperature and precipitation for this year-to-date period, January to July, we see the average temperature was 53.0 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit above average. That translates to the 14th warmest such year-to-date period on record. Looking at the temperature percentiles map on the left-hand side of the slide, we see above average temperatures across much of the West, the Northern and Central Plains, the Great Lakes, the Northeast, the Mid-Atlantic, and parts of the Southeast. California, Nevada, and Oregon had their fourth warmest January to July on record. We also saw below average temperatures across portions of the South. Precipitation-wise, for the first 7 months of the year, we averaged 18 inches even, which was 0.09 inches below average, but that actually translates to a near average year-to-date period. Looking at the precipitation percentiles map on the right-hand side of the slide, we see below average precipitation from the West Coast to the Western Great Lakes. We see that Minnesota and North Dakota both ranked third driest on record for this period, and Montana fourth driest. Wetter than average precipitation we saw from the southern and central plains up through the Midwest and over towards the Southeast. Mississippi ranked sixth wettest for this period. Now, looking at the latest U.S. drought monitor on slide number six that was released this morning, we see that approximately 47% of the contiguous U.S. is currently in drought. This is just shy of a percentage point increase since mid-July. And we see that due to the onset of the monsoon season in portions of southwestern U.S., we saw some drought severity lessen in the last 3 to 4 weeks, over parts of the Southwest, specifically the Four Corners states. We saw a degradation in drought conditions across the Northwest of the West Coast, as well as the Northern Tier states and portions of the Northern Plains. Looking outside of the contiguous U.S., we saw drought expand a little bit across East Central Alaska, and we saw intensification of drought across the island of Maui in Hawaii, as well as drought lessening across the southern coast of Puerto Rico. And with that, I will turn it over to Dan McAvoy and slide number seven.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Karen. Let me move on here to the next slide. I apologize here. Okay, so now on to slide seven. So Karen provided a very nice lead into this with the current drought depiction and the dryness so far for this calendar year. But what I want to emphasize is that for much of the western U.S., this is now the second year in a row with drought conditions, and even longer than that for some places in some states throughout the West. And the map there on the left is showing the two-year statewide precipitation rankings. And the white numbers in several states are the precipitation rankings for each state, with one being the driest. And so we see that there are seven western states that have a ranking of ninth driest or less. Utah experienced its driest two-year August through July on record, and California had its second driest. And so if you move over to the graph on the right, this is an example for the Sierra Nevada in California, the Sierra Nevada climate region. And the snowpack in this region serves as a major water resource for California. And what we see is that the past 2 years in the Sierra Nevada have been extremely dry, with this year, 2021, being the third driest on record at 46% of average, and this is the water year precipitation, so October through July, and last year, 2020 water year, was the 13th driest on record at just 64% of average. And so once you get into these multiple years of drought or longer, you wind up with much higher odds of having major drought impacts when you have these multiple dry years in a row. So moving on now to slide eight, one thing I want to highlight here is a feature of the drought this summer and several recent summers have been a very high atmospheric evaporative demand or atmospheric thirst. And this is basically the amount of water that the atmosphere wants to take off of the land surface based on the weather conditions. And so the map here shows the evaporative demand drought index for the past 3 months that was ending August 11th. And the reds on this map indicate well above normal evaporative demand. And so this has not only been driven by hot temperatures, but this also includes humidity, wind, and solar radiation. And so this also means lower humidities, windy conditions, and excessive clear skies. And so the red areas reflect places that are likely seeing increased vegetative stress, drier soil moistures, and this is very well correlated to high fire danger. And so as we move on to the next slide, slide 9, we see on the left the locations of the current large fires. This was as of August 17th. And you'll notice that the circles there on that map, each circle is an active large fire, corresponds pretty well to the red areas that I was talking about on the previous evaporative demand drought index map. And so what we are seeing with the fire activity is, yes, there are currently a number of large fires, mostly throughout the northern Rockies, Washington, Oregon, and northern California. But if we consider the entire U.S. and look at the number of fires and the acres burned so far this year, it does not stand out as an anomaly. It's actually pretty close to normal for both of those numbers, acres burned and number of fires. But what we are seeing this year is pretty remarkable is the growth and the spread and the fire behavior on some of these individual fires, like the Dixie Fire that I've highlighted there in Northern California. And that number of 605,511 acres was from a couple days ago, and it has continued to grow closer to 700,000 acres as of this morning. And so the drought is being exacerbated by extreme heat, and that has left bone-dry fuel loads, and these fires are just exploding once they're ignited. And so they're generating these huge pyrocumulus clouds or smoke clouds up into the atmosphere, and they're pumping incredible amounts of smoke around the western U.S. and at times even reaching the east coast of the U.S. And so this is the second year in a row now we're seeing these types of fire behavior conditions as well as air quality conditions throughout the West. And so these smoke conditions, the top right map shows the air quality index for August 17th, and you can see widespread poor air quality. And these kind of conditions are persisting for weeks or longer at a time. So it's a poor situation there. And finally, on slide 10, I want to touch on the water supply impacts of this drought. And the big news that came out this week was that the first ever federal shortage was declared on the Colorado River. And this was due to Lake Mead falling below the stage one threshold. And so the graph I have up there on the left is showing the Lake Mead water level since when it was filled in 1935 to present, and it has fallen below that red line showing the stage one shortage threshold. And so this is in part due to the last couple of years of drought, but the water supply in the Colorado River Basin has actually been declining for about the past 20 years now, and so this is a bigger problem than just the past 2 years. And so this shortage, this is going to mostly impact Arizona and Nevada beginning in 2022 with reduced water supply. And then, so I already mentioned the low precipitation the past 2 years in the Sierra Nevada, and that's led to critically low reservoir levels throughout California. And the graph there on the right shows the percent of capacity in blue numbers and the percent of average in red numbers for major reservoirs throughout California. And I've highlighted in the red box there Lake Oroville, which is currently at 34% of average, and that recently became the record low storage for that reservoir. And so one of the impacts of that, for example, is that this has forced the first ever shutdown of the hydroelectric power plant that was built there in 1967. And so these water supply drought impacts are really starting to stack up. And with that, I will pass it over to Matt.
Thanks, Dan. So on slide 11, sea surface temperature map on the left, it indicates that there are still below normal sea surface temperatures across the central Pacific Ocean in the equatorial region. The latest Niño 3.4 value, the latest weekly value, is minus 0.4 degrees Celsius. So it's below normal, but not quite at the threshold for La Niña. Correspondingly, we are seeing atmospheric conditions that more reflect ENSO neutral conditions, where we have had some enhanced trade winds across the central Pacific, especially kind of later July, in the first week of August. But then those in the towards the middle of August, those kind of relaxed a little bit as we had some intra-seasonal oscillations and variability that happens on the week-to-week time scale kind of come through and weaken those trade winds a little bit. The upper level winds up at about 40,000 feet, those are not supportive of ENSO conditions right now. So that's why with the mixed bag, you end up with an ENSO neutral conditions. Going forward in time, the latest ENSO outlook was issued last Thursday. It does indicate an ENSO neutral through the when we look at the entire July, August, and September period, with about a 60% chance for ENSO neutral. But then as we get into the Northern Hemisphere autumn, the August, September, October, and especially into the September, October, November period, it does look like the chances for La Nina increase, and they increase relative to last month's outlook for the August, September, and September, October, November period. We are likely to have a La Nina through the winter, with odds peaking at about 70% for La Nina during November, December, January. Corresponding with those increased odds for La Nina are dramatically decreased odds relative to climatology for El Nino. So it's basically it's almost certain that El Nino is off the table. The odds for that are in the single digits. The impact to the outlooks, if we move to slide 12, there's little impact from El Nino that or La Nina, the ENSO system, on the monthly forecast. It more plays into the seasonal forecast. But the monthly forecast does rely on other modes of variability in the tropics. And those were between those modes and the dynamical models we have and the antecedent conditions where it's been dry and warm out to the west and very wet in the southern plains. The soil moisture does have an impact through at least the first half of September. It does have some predictive capabilities there. So that did play a role into the outlook here. The dry conditions out west and the ongoing warmth that was highlighted early in the presentation, that does have some persistence and predictive power for into September. Those kind of wane as you go into October, November for impacts. But the outlook does call for above normal temperatures, basically from the southwest to the northern plains and then over to the Great Lakes and into the northeast. There's quite a large area of EC, which is equal chances for the Great Plains and into the southeast, because we are expecting highly variable conditions there. A lot of variability throughout the month, which did not yield a signature for above normal, below normal temperatures. We do expect below normal temperatures that have been observed in the southern plains and the lower Mississippi Valley to likely continue through September. There's no real strong signals in Alaska for above normal temperatures or below normal temperatures for the month of September. For precipitation in the eastern U.S., we are expecting above normal precipitation, basically from the Gulf Coast up to the Great Lakes into the Mid-Atlantic region. Again, that variable pattern can lead to a lot of frontal passages and moisture surges. The dry conditions are expected to continue out to the west, especially from basically Southern California up to Montana and to the Northern Plains. There might be some wetness coming into the Alaska Panhandle, along with below normal precipitation favored for western Alaska. So kind of a dual pole structure for over top of Alaska. Looking at the September, October, November outlook on slide 13, the outlook does call for above normal temperatures for Alaska, for most of Alaska, except for Southeast Alaska and the Alaska Panhandle. The highest odds are for western and northern Alaska, where during the October-November period, the sea ice is likely to be further away from the shore than climatology. So that would support, that strongly favors above normal temperatures for the northern and western coasts. When we look at the southern, or the CONUS, contiguous U.S., there were strong signals in trend, dynamical models, and impacts from La Nina, which would be later in the season, for warmth on above normal temperatures in the southwest all the way up to base, and then all the north to kind of the north central Rockies. but there are some indications that later in the season we can end up with a cooler period. And trends also, and long-term trends would also favor cooler than normal temperatures from the Pacific Northwest to the Northern Plains. So that kind of was a counter piece of information to the some of the dynamical model forecasts that have had above normal temperatures there. So it ended up with an equal chances area. Strong trends favor, and they have autumn favor above normal temperatures in the Northeast. And then the below normal temperatures for September that are forecast played into potentially having a more normal outcome for the lower Mississippi Valley from that perspective. But there were some other tools that had an above normal forecast for, especially for the Southeast portions like Mississippi and Alabama. So we ended up with conflicting signals there, which resulted in an equal chances outlook. Going for the precipitation, below normal precipitation is favored from the Four Corners region up into the Northern Plains. That's a consistent signal. A lot of the model tools and would be a consistent signal with an early start to the beginning portions of a La Nina. And then as well as the potential for above normal precipitation in the Alaska Panhandle, that is a signature related with the early portions of La Nina. How all that plays out in the U.S. drought outlook on slide 14 is that for a lot of the western U.S., we are expecting droughts to persist, given that a lot of the western U.S. has near, you know, equal chances or below normal precipitation favored for the September, October, November period. There is some potential for drought recovery, elimination and improvement in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon and Washington, especially west of the Cascades and the out towards the coastal areas. There's also some potential for improvement in southern Wisconsin and in the central parts of the Appalachians, where once summertime temperatures go down, the evaporative demand kind of goes down a lot in the eastern U.S., and you have potential for recharge there. That's all I have, and back to you, John.
All right, thanks so much, Matt. We will now take specific questions from the call participants, if you have any. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question, if possible. Ali, could you please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
Certainly. Thank you, John. We will now queue up for question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please dial star one now. You may be prompted to record your first name clearly. Please record your first name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To cancel that request, press star two. One moment, please, as we wait for those questions to queue up here. All right, and it looks like we do see some questions queuing up here. The first question comes from Chelsea Goad. Chelsea, your line is now open. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my question. This is Chelsea Goad with Space.com, and my question is for Dan. You mentioned that this is the second year in a row with what we're seeing, these massive smoke transports, you know, all the way from the western coast to the eastern coast. And this being just the second year in a row that we're seeing this, and with these escalating temperatures and record numbers when it comes to both temperature and drought among other variables, what do you think this will mean for years to come when it comes to this massive amounts of smoke transport as we're seeing more and more wildfires, heating up temperatures, et cetera?
Yeah, thank you for the question. This is Dan McAvoy. Well, you know, all signs really point to this becoming a more likely scenario in future summers. As you mentioned, temperatures are projected to continue to warm. You know, precipitation variability plays a huge role here, and we will still have some wet years in the mix. But with the temperatures continuing to increase, the fuels will continue to rapidly dry out and become more flammable and be able to burn quicker and spread faster and produce these pyrocumulus. So we do expect more of this in the future under a warming climate.
All right. Thank you for your question, Chelsea. And our next question comes from Joan Gralla. Joan, your line is now open. Go ahead with your question, please.
Good morning. I appreciate your taking my call. It's basically two questions. New York was the wettest. Could you give us the comparison, please, for that? And also, can you assess, if you don't mind, what the three-month outlook means for the Mid-Atlantic region in any more detail?
This is Karen Gleason. I can speak to New York ranking wettest for July. Basically, what that means is out of the entire period of record for the U.S., that the average precipitation across the entire state was the highest value that we've seen on record. I would have to look up and see what the previous record was, but that's the interpretation, is that the record wettest state is an average amongst the stations in the state, and that average value surpasses all previous values from all the other years on record. So I hope that answers your question. Certainly, if you want more specifics about New York and what different years rank amongst the top years, I'd be glad to, answer that offline, and John can put you in touch with me after the call.
That'd be great. Are you pinning this on ELSA?
There's more than just ELSA, but certainly ELSA, contributed, in parts of the state to that total. So it being a month-long total, I'm sure there were other features that contributed to that, but that certainly was a factor for sure.
Okay, and is there any way to give any more guidance on the Mid-Atlantic region?
Meaning guidance with respect to how much precipitation occurred, or with what?
No, forgive me. I'm very sorry. For the three-month outlook or the one-month outlook? I mean, are the weather patterns setting up to steer storms away or towards the Mid-Atlantic, Gulf Coast storms?
Hi, so this is Matthew Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. Actual individual storm tracks are such as from a hurricane storm track or even an individual storm that kind of comes out of Canada and the mid-latitudes. Those are not really predictable, the storm tracks, any more than about 2 weeks out. You can do clusters of storms, but you can't do an individual storm track. Right now, our forecast does call for what's called equal chances, which basically means a near normal, a normal possibilities for a normal range of events. So climatology would be your best potential outlook for the Mid-Atlantic region. And Mid-Atlantic region, southern New England has about 12 inches of precip during the southern September, October, November period. And that goes to about 11.7 inches when you get to the coastal Mid-Atlantic region. Is there one for the September, October, November period?
Oh, okay. That's terrific. So 11.7 for Mid-Atlantic and 12 inches in the...
12.24 for the climate division is what we call southern New England, and that extends from northern New Jersey up to Hudson Valley, and across the Connecticut River Valley.
Oh, that's very good to know. So what do you define as Mid-Atlantic then, please?
That would be kind of the Appalachians in Pennsylvania down to kind of northern Virginia and then eastward out to Maryland's eastern shore, Delaware, and central New Jersey.
And New York fits in both or one?
New York is actually split into three climate divisions.
There's
the one that grabs southern New York and the Hudson Valley. Then there's climate division that kind of grabs the Adirondacks and down towards Binghamton. And then there's another climate division that will go grabs around the lakes and then also into northern Pennsylvania and northern Ohio.
All right, that's terribly complicated. I really appreciate your explanation.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and at this time, I'm showing we have no more questions in the queue, so I will turn it back over to John Bateman.
All right, thanks, Ali. If there are no further questions, I'll wrap up the call. I would like to thank all of our speakers for their time and to everyone else for participating in this conference call. And I will end by reminding everyone to mark your calendar for a couple of upcoming events. The release of the August 2021 U.S. Climate Report is scheduled for September 9th, and the release of the August 2021 Global Climate Report is scheduled for September 14th. Lastly, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov Media Advisory site later today. And if you have any further informational needs, you can please just reach out to me by email. Once again, that email address is, and I'll spell it, nesds.pa@noaa.gov. And my contact information is also available at the top of the media advisory. Thank you.
Thank you. And that does conclude today's conference. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect your lines. Speakers, please remain on the line with me for a final line count and a post-conference.